Hello and welcome to the Women with Grit podcast with me, Susanna Butcher. I'll be talking to some amazing women in business who are truly inspirational, sharing stories about vulnerability, resilience, and of course, grit, my favourite word. Thanks for tuning in. So in today's interview, I speak to Balbir, who is a grief recovery specialist and speaker. Now, I think Balbir has possibly had one of the most challenging and roller coaster and inspiring life stories that I've ever heard. But despite so many difficulties and challenges in her life, she has gone on to work in a field which a lot of people might avoid given her circumstances, but she has chosen to kind of step forward and be incredibly courageous and inspiring, and now helps other people who have experienced loss, and particularly loss through suicide. Now, there is a trigger warning for this interview because we do speak about a number of issues that may be difficult for some listeners, such as suicide, bipolar disorder, and also mental health and depression. So I'll pop some links in the interview notes just in case that's something that might affect you. But I know that after listening to this, you're just going to think, wow, if she can do this, if Balbir can do this, I can do anything. So you will definitely end up feeling inspired by this interview today. I hope that you enjoy it.
Yeah. Hi there, Balbir. Thank you so much for joining me on the Women with Grit podcast this morning. How are you today?
Hi, good morning, Susanna. Thank you very much indeed for giving me this opportunity to share my story with you and your listeners.
Thank you. So as I ask everybody when we first get started about the word grit, which, as you know, I love, what does that word kind of, what brings to mind when you hear the word grit?
The word grit to me means literally through gritted teeth. Mm. So you keep going, you don't give up, and whatever comes your way, you deal with it. So it's a bit like being really resilient.
Yes.
Because I believe that life is tough, and sometimes you do need that. You just need to grit your teeth and just get on with it.
Yeah, and you've certainly had a really challenging life. And I spoke to you last week and we kind of had a pre-podcast chat, and I was just afterwards I felt so inspired by you, and I just thought I can't wait to share your story with people because I know that it's going to help a lot of people. But obviously it does make for tough listening at times, so I will pop a little thing at the beginning of this podcast just to let people know there might be some triggers in here. So if you don't mind kind of going back, I know that you had a really difficult childhood. You were born into domestic violence. Your mum had what was called manic depression at the time, obviously, which we now know is bipolar, and she'd spent a lot of time away from the family home in hospital. What was life like on a kind of day-to-day basis for you?
Life was really tough. It meant what I can remember, and most of my memory that I can remember clearly is from the age of 12. Prior to that, it's all a bit vague because there was no happiness there. There was no sort of joy, so it's I have very few really sort of vivid memories of that. But from the age of 12, I was at secondary school, so it was me and Dad at home, and me doing all the domestics and getting up, going to school, coming home, doing the cooking, doing my homework, and a bit of telly before Dad would get home. Because when he got home, then there was no telly. So it was doing all the domestics. It was really tough.
Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility when you're such a young age as well.
Yeah, huge. There was no fun. There was no joy. There was no celebration of birthdays. It was all just really tough.
Yeah. And I guess. Sorry, I.
Others. Yeah. Watching others, you know, sort of having fun. So even friends, school friends, I couldn't have them round. I couldn't go out. I couldn't go to school outings when teachers were going along. no school, no friends, parties.
Yeah, so quite sad, kind of lonely childhood for you, really. And I'm not surprised when you say you don't really have many memories, because obviously we talked a bit before about kind of that disassociation, and you do block when things are so painful and so horrible, you kind of do block them out in a way, don't you? So school, in a way, was like a place for you, was like a refuge for you. It was an escape from your home life, and you excelled at school, thankfully. How did that kind of help you? How did going into education help you, and how did your teachers help you and your peers?
Well, going to school, it gave me a sense of significance. So it was one area where I could do well and get praise. And that's what I think spurred me on, because at home there was no praise. And there were, teacher-wise, it was a bit limited. I just remember one teacher who had a great impact on me. It was actually when I was doing my A-levels. I was doing A-level sociology, and we had a temporary teacher come in, and she was asking us all what we were aspiring to be. And I can't remember what I said, but whatever I said made her say that, no, you are much more capable than that.
Oh, wow. That must have been so lovely for you to hear that.
And I'll never forget that.
Yeah.
Wow, she's seen something in me, something that nobody else had.
Yeah.
That was amazing.
Oh, that's lovely.
Forever.
Yes, I'll bet. Yeah.
And I think that's what spurred me on to actually enter an essay writing competition for sociology. And I was one of the 10 runners up in this national competition. And I won a year's subscription to the magazine New Society.
Oh, well done. That must have been such a huge achievement for you at that time as well.
It was.
Yeah. Did your dad show that he was kind of proud of you at any time, or?
Not that I remember, no.
Oh, so sad. Because you just want that. It means so much when people take an interest. When you're a child, you just want someone to be interested in your work and praise what you're doing. And it's, but yeah, I'm glad that you got something from your teachers at least. Did your cultural restrictions affect you kind of growing up as well? Because I know you said that your childhood was pretty joyless, but that was mainly down to your kind of family. Were there any other cultural kind of restrictions?
There were. I remember I wanted to do gymnastics after school, so I wasn't allowed to do that because you had to come straight home. I wasn't allowed to play the recorder. So when I first started secondary school, it was like everybody starts to learn the recorder, but it wasn't the done thing for an Indian girl to be learning.
Right.
So I wasn't allowed to learn that. Loads of restrictions. I couldn't wear what I want. I couldn't. Yeah, so many restrictions. So,
yeah.
It was almost like I was being groomed for marriage. So as long as I was learning how to do all the domestics, so I can knit, I can sew, I can cook, you know, all the domestics I'm really, really good at. In fact, I used to call myself a domestic goddess.
Oh, I wish I was one of those. Oh. So yeah, so you obviously, but at that age you shouldn't have been a domestic goddess. It's nice to do it when you enjoy it, but not when you're kind of forced to do it.
Not when you're forced to do it. With no washing machines, right, in those days.
Yes, yeah.
No hoovers, no washing machines, all the big sheets and everything has to be washed in the bathtub.
Yeah, so it's really hard work.
Yeah, no steam irons either. Mm-hmm. It was lying a blanket on the table. And then getting your iron out and doing it that way.
Yeah. Gosh.
Yeah.
Busy time. Oh. So you went on, you did your A-levels, which is amazing. And then sadly, you suffered the most awful loss when you were 18. Yeah. And your father sadly chose to take his own life, which is just so tragic. You know, would you mind telling me a bit about that time and kind of what happened afterwards?
Yeah, so I finished my A-levels and had the summer holidays, and I started college. I started doing a secretarial course, which I was really getting into. I was really enjoying learning the shorthand, as I really picked it up really, really quickly. That was started in September, and in October, sort of early October, my dad took his own life at home, and then I found him. Mm. And in one day then, my life changed.
God.
And there was, I had no idea, no idea at all.
Oh, that must have been so, oh, I can't even begin to imagine how horrible that must have been for you, just so incredibly traumatic, and at such a young age as well, when your life is really just beginning, you know, you're 18 and you're starting on your course and you're seeing some kind of freedom, and then you lose everything. You know, how did you even begin to move on from that? Where did you go to live, and you know, what happened?
Yeah, it was pretty horrific, and I dissociated some more. That was the only way I could deal with it. As soon as I saw him, I sort of went into another world. Being surreal, you know, the ambulance coming round, taking him, everything. And then I used to live in East London. So in one day, my dad died. I moved to Croydon to live with my brother. I took my cat with us. My cat ran away. Lost my cat.
Oh.
And I lost my friends. So because I stayed over in Croydon then.
Yeah. So it was just a complete restart on everything, really, wasn't it?
I lost my home, the environment I lived in, and I knew so well. So I had to move to a different area that I didn't know, wasn't familiar with.
Mm.
So yeah, there were so many changes just in one day.
So did you get was there any kind of support at that time in terms of like bereavement counselling? Were you offered anything at that time?
I wasn't offered anything. No, this was back in 1981.
Mm.
No help offered whatsoever. So I moved to Croydon to live with family. And then I started work in the January. My dad died in October. In January, I started work because I couldn't go to college anymore. My head wasn't in the right space to continue with college. So my education finished at that point.
Yeah.
And I started work in the civil service.
Mm. And you met your husband around that time as well?
I met my ex-husband there. I mean, we met after 6 months. He used to work in the same building, so that was in London, in Victoria. And we met after 6 months, and a year later we were married.
Yeah. So married quite young.
Quite young. I was 20 when I got married.
Yeah.
And then I moved again. So I moved over to Middlesex.
Yeah. So another big change for you then at that time.
Yeah. And we lived with my in-laws then.
Yeah.
So I moved into, although we didn't have an arranged marriage, we met at work.
Mm.
But the living style was as if we'd had an arranged marriage.
Right. So you had to kind of leave everything then and then start again with your husband and his family. Yeah. And then... So just 3 years after then you'd lost your dad, your mum tragically passed away. She'd kind of been in and out of hospital over the years anyway, and she'd experienced a stroke, which must have been awful for you anyway, knowing that she was so poorly. And then when you, just the day before you were 20, was it day before you were 21, it was her funeral, and you were pregnant. I just can't. It just must have been, it just does beyond belief that all these awful things are kind of happening to you. You know, how on earth did you even begin to cope with all that stuff?
I don't even know, Susanna, because I just remember thinking that I was married then, I was pregnant, and my mum was where she was. She was on the other side of London in hospital then. And I thought, you know, life is settling down now.
Mm.
And then out of the blue, I get a call one day for me to go over to the hospital. It was one afternoon. And so we went over and I saw her in A&E. They sort of barely covered and discovered she'd had a stroke. And it was, what's the word? In terms of how much that hurt at that time, it hurt even more than Dad going. Because my mum was the sort of person we thought we'd just be there forever.
Yes, yeah.
This little woman, you know, and then she'll just keep going and going.
Yeah.
And a part of me really wanted her, after my dad's death, to be okay. I wanted my mum.
Because
I never had a mum.
Yeah, and I guess some thoughts as well, because you said that you thought that she would always be okay, I guess because you felt like she was looked after, even though she wasn't with you. She was in a place where you would expect her to sort of be safe. I know she wasn't well, but you'd expect her to be safe. So yeah, it must have just come as such a shock to you. But when we talked last week, there was one lovely moment that, if you wouldn't mind sharing, that I asked if she understood, you know, when you told her that you were expecting your baby, and you said that she did.
She She did, yeah, because she had one stroke, and so I told her that I was pregnant. I wasn't sure whether she'd understand, and she did. She got it, and then I got the only bit of affection I've ever had from her, and that was like she put her hand on my face, on my cheek, like that.
Aww.
And that was the only time I experienced any sort of affection from her.
Oh, I bet you'll treasure that little moment though, that with her. So sadly, obviously, she ended up passing away, and then you discovered you suddenly became ill when you were pregnant with what you thought was flu, which actually turned out then to be malaria. How did you contract malaria, and how did you find out that it actually was malaria?
Oh, blimey, that was a bit of a nightmare. Yeah,
I should think it was. Goodness.
I was vomiting everywhere, and I had high temperature and everything, so they did all these tests, and eventually they decided to test for malaria because I'd been to India the year before for a honeymoon, and I'd run out of malaria tablets while I was out there, and then I had to go to hospital. So my mum's funeral was the day before I was 21, and then in the following couple of weeks I was really ill, and I ended up in hospital for a couple of weeks, and then I had to finish taking the medication after my son was born.
Right, yeah, because obviously they wanted to make sure that he was safe as well, and presumably they're quite kind of potent, the medications that they treat you with. So thankfully you did recover from that. You went on to have your lovely children. Your son was born healthily, and then you had your daughter when you were 24. How was family life for you at that time when you had your sort of two young kids?
Yeah, family life was pretty tough. It was a very traditional Indian family life, meaning the daughter-in-law has a certain role to play there, which is purely domestic, really. The only worth, my only worth and value was in the kitchen, serving others, serving the in-laws.
Right.
Because even when I was ill with the malaria, the expectation still was that I would get on with things.
So they didn't help or support you when you were so poorly?
No. It was, you're only useful if you are, it was pretty tough going.
It must be after going from such an awful childhood as well, when you just want to be in a new family that you would expect would kind of take you under their wing and love you and look after you, and that's just so sad that didn't happen for you. Was your husband supportive, or was he very sort of similar, you kind of just got to get on with it?
He was, it's quite sad what happens to the men then, because you're living with the family and they get torn. They're sort of stuck in the middle between the wife and their mum. And so it was tough, because his own family are going to come first.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. Yeah. So I was way down the pecking order, way down.
Yeah. So you remained married for a time, and you ended up moving. Your marriage sadly ended after you found out that your husband was having an affair. But then after your marriage ended, things kind of did begin to shift a little bit for you after kind of having all these difficulties. And you attended a Women's Returner course, and you started reading, and you read about a book about assertiveness. So what kind of things were going on for you at that time after your marriage had ended, and your mind started to kind of expand a little bit?
Actually, the Women's Returner course was just as the marriage was ending, so the marriage was on the rocks when I was on the course, and I was reading these books, and one particular book was A Woman in Your Own Right, which was about assertiveness. And suddenly I became aware of how I was functioning, which was very sort of passive aggressive and very submissive. And I suddenly started to sort of join a few dots on how I was being treated, and then how I was reacting, and how I'd grown up. So it really did start to open my mind. So what I thought was the norm and was okay before that, I suddenly realized, actually, hang on a minute. No, this is why I continue to be unhappy. This is why I continue to be treated the way I'm being treated.
Yeah.
So it started to change my thinking completely.
So things were, I guess, kind of improving. Then you had another really awful loss because your son, after a year, went to live with his father and he was only 9. You know, that must have just had another massive impact on you.
Oh, absolutely. It was so, I was, a year after the marriage broke up. Then my son went to live 100 miles away with his dad and the extended family. That's what he'd been used to and so on. And so my children then grew up apart. My daughter stayed with me and my son went to live over there. And so we would see each other sort of periodically. And it meant a lot of driving, a lot of heartache. And really sad. And that again, you know, if I thought my losing my dad was tough and then losing my mum, and then that happened, and there was an attempt to also get my daughter to move. Thankfully that didn't work. It was just horrific. It was, you know, I just used to think, it's like, what else can happen?
Yeah, you get to a point and you think, I've had it now, stop. You can't throw anything else at me, you know, that this has got to be it. Thankfully both your children are amazing and they've both done really well, which is a real credit to you, and you've got great relationships with them now. So you obviously, after all these awful things had happened to you, you were, this has got to be it. Thankfully both your children are amazing and they've both done really well, which is a real credit to you, and you've got great relationships with them now. So you obviously, after all these awful things had happened to you, you were at a time when you really needed to heal. I know when we spoke before, you'd seen all these things that people had done to kind of rid their pain, like in your mum's case, medication, and you knew you didn't want that. You weren't going to go down those paths, so you decided that actually you would, you know, you got depressed as well, obviously, after what had happened. You went to see your doctor, and he recommended psychotherapy, is that right?
Yeah, and I'd also seen, before I went to see him, I'd seen a film. So I knew I didn't want all the other stuff, like you mentioned, not the alcohol, the medication or anything else. I'd seen this film called Prince of Tides with Barbara Streisand and Nick Nolte, in where she's the counsellor. And then towards the end, they uncover the trauma that he'd gone through, but he buried so deep. But it had been affecting his marriage, his relationship with his children and his work, impacting his whole life. And that got me thinking about myself. And then it also showed, the film also showed, you know, what happened to him afterwards, how freer he felt, how much lighter he felt. And the doctor also picked up with me then, you know, I didn't have anybody to talk to. So I went for psychotherapy for 3 years, week in, week out.
Yeah.
Where, you know, most of the time I would leave the session in tears.
Yeah.
That was pretty tough.
Well, there, I guess there was just so much to work through. And obviously at that time, as we sort of said earlier, you were dealing with mainly the loss of your son and obviously your divorce, which was quite in themselves a major life event, which take a long time to get over. But it was quite superficial in a way, because obviously you had all the other stuff as well going on that you hadn't really processed. But you went on to discover NLP, which just fascinates me. I love NLP. I did a course, a very short course on NLP when I used to work with a young people's advisory service. And I would love to learn more about it. Tell me how you discovered it and the sort of training that you went on, and how that really was a big shift for you when you found out about NLP.
Right, wow. So, I stopped psychotherapy when I thought, I'm still getting depressed here, nothing has shifted. And I asked the universe, I didn't know that's what I was doing at that time, but sort of said out loud, you know, there's got to be something better than this way of counselling. And I think I read something in a local paper somewhere about a group, which turned out to be an NLP practice group. And I went along, and then the same man, the trainer, was giving some free talks, and I went along to those. And I had some one-to-one with him. And the one-to-one actually blew me away, absolutely blew me away. It's a solution-focused method, whereas the psychotherapy was problem-focused. We were just looking at the why. Now, he was asking me, you know, what do I want? Mm-hmm. And he was the first man in my life at that age, I don't know what I was, about 33, 34, to ask me, what do you want?
Mm. Must have thrown you quite a little bit then to actually, for somebody to ask you that after never being asked that before.
Never being asked. I'd always been told. As a child, I was told what to do. I was controlled. Dad was very controlling. And in my marriage, I knew what I had to do. So it wasn't actually, you know, what do I want to do? It was a matter of getting on with it. And then all of a sudden, I go for this counselling, what I just thought was another type of counselling. And he said to me, you know, what do you want? And I went back the following week with the, you know, the shorthand sort of notepads that reporters had.
Yes, yes.
So I went along with one side full of stuff.
Yeah.
A whole little 85 page full of stuff of what I wanted. I was very clear about what I wanted. And that was and working with him one-to-one was the first time that we touched on my dad's death.
Mm.
We hadn't done that in any meaningful way during the 3 years I've been going for the psychotherapy.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely enlightening. Then I did his practitioner course,
mm-hmm.
which was a 20-day course then. And that was like doing a degree for me. You know, the level of the language I had to get used to, the study and that, the reading, that was my degree.
It must have been really intense as well in that short period. It must have been a lot of work for you.
It was a lot of work. It was spread out. The 20 days were spread out over 3 months.
Mm.
And it was absolutely intense for me. But I enjoyed it. I loved every single minute of it. Every single. And I couldn't wait to go to the next sort of lot of training.
Mm.
And it was then, because I was also searching then for what am I going to do with my life?
Mm.
So all the time I was married, and up until then, I'd always worked part-time. I'd left the civil service years ago to look after my son. And I thought, what am I going to do now? And it was on that course that I also read another NLP book, and I went through it, through these exercises, and I sort of really looked at myself and what had been going on with me from a young age. And it turned out that I'm really good at listening and helping others and really non-judgmental. So that's when I sort of decided that my future would be working one-to-one with people and with groups.
Yeah.
But everything that I would do would be with an NLP foundation.
Yeah. How did that manifest then? So did you start, when did you start? Because I know you had your successful Harley Street Relationship Centre.
Yeah.
Was that soon after that you decided to open that up?
That was 5 years later.
Yeah.
So in fact, I set a goal on the NLP course on that very first one. And then I remember, because you do this exercise where you put a goal into your future. Mm-hmm. And I was being asked, you know, where are you working? What is the surrounding like? What's the environment like? And I remember describing it. And then I got on with life and I had to sort of learn how to train people and so on. So there's a huge sort of learning curve that was involved. And then one day an email landed in my box saying there's a room at Harley Street.
Wow.
Because I was looking for some premises to work in.
Yeah.
And I started working there. And it was only after a while, after I'd been there a few months, that it clicked that the outside of the building was like the building I described 5 years earlier on the NLP course.
Oh, wow. So you really manifested. You manifested that. Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. And at that point, I didn't even know, before I started at Harley Street, I didn't know what Harley Street was. I didn't know where it was.
Mm.
I had no idea.
Yeah. And then I started giving goosebumps. I love things like this. When you set out your intention and it comes to you. I'm so happy that happened for you. So you had a lot of success at that time. You're writing for Psychology's magazine, and you were on popular radio shows as well. Is it an Asian radio show?
Yeah.
You're a resident life coach. What was life like for you at that time?
Oh, it was everything I wanted it to be then. Mm-hmm. So I was working in my field. I had great networks. I used to run NLP practice groups. I ran two of those. I'd been on TV a few years earlier as well, talking about my experience as an Asian divorced woman and the stigma around that.
Mm-hmm.
So much had happened. And I felt, I was at the height of my, where I wanted to be. You know, everything that NLP espouses,
yeah,
in terms of goal setting, and you can be and you can achieve, and all the books I'd read, about setting intentions, about overcoming adversity. Mm-hmm. I felt then, yeah, I'd done all that.
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah. Sadly, well, you met somebody who you rescued, because that was your kind of nature, your rescuer. And that was really where things started to go a bit wrong for you. What happened with your sort of clinic and everything after that relationship had ended?
Yeah, sadly, that relationship ended after 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see that coming at all. Yeah. And that sort of, it brought me to my knees, because mm-hmm. then I thought, do you know what? I can't do this again now. Mm-hmm. I really can't do it. I'd felt suicidal many, many years ago when I was getting divorced, when the marriage ended. And I felt so low again now. I didn't feel suicidal, but it absolutely brought me to my knees. And I didn't know how I could get up from this. I didn't know how I could recover from this.
Mm-hmm.
And it, with my shame, I felt shamed, I felt embarrassed, I lost all my confidence as a therapist, as a life coach, as a trainer, and I shut the clinic down.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was so desperate for love and for approval, I put everything into that relationship, thinking that if I do everything for him, then I'll be okay.
Another loss, because you'd lost all these things that you loved in your life, and obviously you loved that, you know, you loved that business and everything was going so well for you, and to have that kind of snatched away from you, I'm not surprised that that kind of did bring you so low at that time. Mm-hmm. Thankfully you did rise again, you amazing woman. Keep coming back up, I love you, you're amazing. So what's happening for you now? Oh, you know, how did you even begin to get back up from that? What did that look like for you?
That was really tough. I withdrew from the NLP world. I lost all my networks. And then somehow I got going again. And I did start 9-to-5 work. And 9-to-5 just doesn't suit me.
No, not me.
9-to-5 doesn't last very long with me. So I gave it a go. I did some temping, and I actually got the highest paid position I'd ever had.
Wow.
As a director of a business link section for disaffected communities. And I resigned from there after 6 months because, yeah, that's just not me. And so I got back into being self-employed and back into being a therapist and life coach, but away from London.
Yeah.
And I became a trustee of a therapy center. So it's in a much smaller way. And I will still keep holding myself back, though.
Mm-hmm.
I still didn't sort of regain the confidence that I had prior to Harley Relationship Center going.
It takes a long time to build it back up, though, doesn't it? It's just tiny steps until you can get back up to that kind of level, really. So what's your business look like now? What are you actually doing at the moment? I'd love to hear more about that.
So at the moment now, I'm niching in suicide grief recovery work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I come from. I've got a really, really good idea of what it takes to do that, and all the sort of what sort of happens to us. And it's not the Kubler-Ross stages of grief either. That doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it's been shown that those don't apply to grief anyway. They were, when she was talking about those, they were applicable in a very different environment.
Right. Is this the stages like the denial and the anger?
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So you work differently to that.
And your suicide grief works differently. And even ordinary grief works differently to that. Mm-hmm. There's been literature out now that, you know, when she brought that up, that was applicable in a very different environment.
Mm-hmm.
Not to grief, not to someone's death, but as such. It was applicable in a very different way. But it got generalised out and applied to grief.
Yeah.
So, but with suicide loss, it's like a roller coaster, and it's even worse than a roller coaster.
Yeah.
Sometimes you're just like, you know, all over the place, sort of just like that.
Yeah. And I had a friend of mine, and I wasn't particularly close to her. I used to work with her, and she committed suicide. And this was a couple of years ago, but it really, we'd been arranging to kind of meet, and she had bipolar, so it was very up and down. She messaged, let's meet up, all really excited, and then we wouldn't end up meeting, and then life would get busy, and then I'd message her, and then I wouldn't hear from her, and then she'd message me, and we never quite got round to meeting up before she died. And gosh, it hit me really hard. Even though I wasn't that close to her, I'd worked with her and she'd helped me, and she was so kind and lovely. And I was just so shocked that she'd killed. And I think about her most days now. You know, it just takes such a long time, and I can't even begin to understand what it's like when you lose someone in that way that is so close to you as well. You know, a close family member or a really close friend. It's amazing that you've gone down this path after what's happened to you, that you've walked into this this life where you're helping other people. I just think it just shows so much courage and kindness within you that you're helping other people in this way.
Oh, thank you, Susanna. Thank you.
That's all right.
And it's taken many years, you know, to get to this point for me to actually specialise in this. Because I've spent many years sort of running away from it. I was going to do this about 2 or 3 years ago, and then I stopped. So I think it's been a journey within myself, my own healing journey, that now I'm actually ready to do this.
Yes. Yeah.
But whereas, a few years ago, even then I couldn't. And it's taken many, many years, because there are so many layers. So many layers to deal with. And they do say what you were saying about your friend, there are lots of different people involved. There are all these sort of circles. So you get the person, people who are very close to that person who are affected. Then you get the outer sort of circle where you get friends who are impacted, work colleagues perhaps. And then you get another ring where you get sort of neighbors and other more distant friends and so on, and that might be the local shop people who knew that person and so on. So there are many people. It sort of ripples out the impact of one person's death and the trauma of that on the people left behind. It sort of has this rippling effect out. And it also depends on who found that person as well. Because with suicide, somebody is going to find that person, and whoever finds that person, whether their family or somebody else, also need help as well.
Yes, I believe it was her family that had found her. But I think it's just so hard, because you can't imagine the pain that someone is going through. And you know, I just think, I wish that I'd been more kind of proactive in getting in touch with her. And I do feel, you know, really sad about that. It's such a, you know, I guess that happens a lot with people that take their own lives, is that they don't often share and they don't reach out.
Sadly, you know, and we're left thinking, you know, the why and the what ifs, a lot of what ifs, if I'd done that, just as you're saying.
If
I'd done this, if I'd done that. Unfortunately, those who are determined to do that, my dad had planned it for ages. And you hear that quite often. So, you know, people, they might have met them an hour beforehand and they would have sort of appeared okay. And then, but because they decided, that's it. You wouldn't have known. So regardless of what you think, if I'd done that or done that, sadly, it wouldn't have made much difference.
No.
It's very, very rare that it would have made much difference when somebody has decided that's the only way to go.
That's true.
And it is. It's quite horrific in that way,
It is. So obviously hearing all these stories must be really difficult for you. And obviously, I'm sure you're well aware now of your own well-being. You know, how do you make sure that you're okay now? You know, what kind of things do you do to look after yourself?
So I love walking in nature.
Me too.
Any sort of walking is good. Yoga. So I'm now a qualified yoga teacher as well, because that's what I want to do with groups and clients in the future as well. There's different types of yoga. Listening to music. I love listening to music. There's all different types of music, my own sort of Indian music, English music, all sorts.
Yeah.
And dancing.
Yeah.
I love dancing. Lovely. Yeah.
Do you go to classes, or do you just kind of do it in the lounge?
I just in the lounge. Yeah. Just, you know, once the music gets going, my body can't keep still.
Yeah. Oh, I watched The Greatest Showman with my daughter the other day. And I don't know if you've seen it. I don't normally like musicals, but the music is so uplifting. And after the film, I felt like that, you know, I just felt we held hands and we were just kind of dancing. It was really lovely. Yeah. Oh, I'm glad that you do take that time to look after yourself.
And I also love watching box sets.
Yeah, me too. Which ones do you like?
Yeah. So there's all different types of box sets I've watched over time.
Yeah.
But some quite dark ones as well.
Yeah, I think they're great to just switch off, aren't they? I mean, we watched loads. Me and my husband watched kind of things like The Handmaid's Tale and Breaking Bad, and you know, all the really kind of popular ones. We really like them. It's a great way to switch off, I think. I know that sometimes entrepreneurs get a bit of rap for watching TV. Yeah. No, that's my time. You know, I've got an hour an evening, and it's just time to just switch off. And I love watching them. So just to end, I know this is probably going to be really difficult for you given your work, and obviously I know you can't kind of counsel people on a podcast, but if someone is struggling, if they've lost someone through suicide, what kind of advice would you give to them? Just some kind of general advice on you know, working forward and how you might help somebody with that loss as well.
Okay, so I have one of my favourite quotes, if I may share that with you.
Yeah, of course.
Is, it's not what happens to you that matters. What matters is what you do with what's happened to you.
Right.
Yeah. That's one of my very favourite quotes. And it, there are quite a few, but that's one of them.
Mm.
And it's to remember that what happened wasn't personal.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess a lot of people do really take it personally, and there must be so much guilt surrounding death by suicide as well. I've obviously expressed my own guilt for someone that I used to work with, and if you're a close friend or family member, there must be so much kind of guilt that you need to work through. So that I'm sure that'll really help a lot of people. And you're obviously practicing now. You've got your website, which I'll link to in the podcast for you as well. Are there any kind of events that you're running coming up, or anything else that you'd like to share in terms of your current work?
I'm working online one-to-one with clients, and I've got a free download ebook on my website, which is about questions you can ask yourself. So it's not me giving advice or anything. It's a book full of different questions around loss.
Yeah.
And so when you ask those, you know, it gets you thinking about different things. So my intention with that is to get people thinking in a different way about what has happened.
Oh, that's really useful. I'll put a link to that in the podcast as well for anyone that wants that. Well, thank you so much, Barbara. That was just such an inspiring interview. I thank you so much for your honesty and for sharing all these, you know, difficulties that you've had. And as I said before, I just think you're truly amazing, and it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Well, thank you so much, Susanna. I really value this time to be able to share my story and to inspire others. You know, in the past, I've listened to a lot of people's stories, and I've read books as well, autobiographies. And I think, we need more people sharing what they've been through. We learn a lot from each other, and from other real human beings.
Yeah.
They're not made up stories. These are real stories.
Yeah, so real people.
Thank you very much, Susanna, for doing that. Thank you.
That's all right. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow, I really hope that you enjoyed that interview. I think that Balbir is just testament to how incredibly strong and resilient human beings can be. And despite everything that she's been through throughout her life, Balbir has really chosen this amazing career where she's helping other people to recover from loss, which is just, it just shows me how incredibly courageous and inspiring that she is. So you can see all the notes for this podcast if you just head over to my website, www.susanna.me/podcast. And I'll also pop links to support services in there as well, just in case you've been affected by anything that we spoke about in today's interview.